the idea that those construction paper headdresses and pilgrims and Indian stories really aren't all that we were taught in school, that there were actually a series of massacres and broken promises that have occurred with the onset of colonization, and that it's not quite so rosy as our children are led to believe. And so I hope that we are able to, you know, come together with our families, if we are able to be with our families, or be together through virtual means or whatever it happens to be, and tell some truth about what the real story is and how we learn from that and move forward together. That includes something like appointing Deb Haaland to the Secretary of the Interior position, overseeing Native affairs. Imagine having a Native person actually overseeing Native affairs for the first time in U.S. history.
Sarah Hausko, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Indigenous lawyer and activist, founder of the Ginu Collective. She is Ojibwe from the Cochiching First Nation. And tune in tomorrow for our holiday special with Jody Archambault of Standing Rock, Ali Young in Arizona, Bree Newsom and Eddie Glaude, as well as Juan Gonzalez on Latino results from the election. And Friday, we re-air our documentary, 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Join KBOO Friday, November 27th at 11 a.m. for an online webinar discussion about President-elect Biden's plans for the Middle East. Our panelists will discuss Israel-Palestine, regional conflict among Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, and the ongoing crisis in Yemen. To register for this event, go to our homepage at kboo.fm or find the event on the KBOO Facebook page. Again, that's our KBOO webinar on Biden's plans for the Middle East on Friday, November 27th at 11 a.m. Find details and the sign-up link online at kboo.fm. For questions and more information, email our public affairs director at publicaffairs@kboo.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, COVID-19 spreads across the state with over 1,000 new daily cases for the 8th day in a row. Houseless people are displaced from Laurelhurst Park in new sweeps. And in national news, President Trump has pardoned former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 25th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. More than 1,000 people have tested positive for coronavirus every day since Governor Kate Brown's freeze took effect on November 18th. On Wednesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 1,189 new cases and 20 more deaths as the state's numbers continue to trend upwards. In total, there have been 68,503 cases in the state, as well as 867 deaths from COVID-19. Oregonians are restricted to social gatherings of no more than 6 people, and multifamily gatherings for the holiday are discouraged. Hospitalizations due to COVID-19 are on the rise, and as of Wednesday, 489 people are in the hospital with the virus. The number of COVID-19 patients in intensive care is 113. Dr. Jennifer Vines is the Tri-County Health Officer. She says hospitals are predicted to run out of beds by December 1st. Jessica Guernsey is the Multnomah County Public Health Director. She wanted to emphasize that the issue isn't just being able to care for people with COVID-19, saying, quote, "If you have a car accident, a heart attack, if you're in need of a hospital bed or emergency services, hospital beds filling up means filling up for everything, and we will not be able to get people in. We're really trying to focus our efforts on not having that happen," end quote. She added that health officials are pleading with Oregonians to stay home and save lives. The Oregon Health Authority announced today that they expect to receive vaccine shipments in December. They expect to have the capacity to vaccinate up to 30,000 people. Frontline workers treating people with COVID-19 will, of course, be first to receive the vaccine, and the OHA indicated that they plan to choose who's next by looking through a, quote, equity framework. The encampment suite at Laurelhurst Park continued today as city contractors forced residents to pack up and move. The sweeps come at a time when COVID-19 numbers are at an all-time high in Portland and temperatures are dipping low. The city had completely stopped campsite removal at the beginning of the pandemic, citing guidance from the CDC that aimed to slow the spread of COVID-19. Now, the sweeps have drawn dozens of protesters seeking to support the houseless population during this displacement. City officials say they planned the sweep in conjunction with the opening of a shelter at Mount Scott Community Center in early November. So far, most people camped out at Laurelhurst Park have not gone to the community center but have joined other encampments nearby. Mayor Ted Wheeler has celebrated the sweep of the wealthy Southeast Portland neighborhood, saying it's a model he intends to implement across the city. He said, quote, "While we want to be compassionate to those on the streets, we have to respect the fact that people don't want their doorways blocked, they don't want their businesses blocked, they don't want their sidewalks impeded. But many advocates for houseless folks disagree, saying it's a violation of human dignity. And as Amy Niles, a hospital chaplain providing assistance to people around the park this week, put it, quote, "To have this happen on the week of Thanksgiving, to come through here to take away someone's home, that's soul damage. There's also a possibility of increased COVID-19 exposure. The sweeps will continue after a brief break for the Thanksgiving holiday tomorrow." According to a new study from the nonprofit group Oregon Walks, Black Portlanders are 3 times as likely to be struck and killed by a vehicle. The traffic safety group publicized major findings from 2017 to 2019 ahead of its study set to come out next year. All 48 pedestrian fatalities between 2017 and 2019 occurred in neighborhoods below median income, and the pedestrian death rate was 3 times higher east of 82nd Avenue, the road that marks where East Portland begins. Neighborhoods in that area are far more racially diverse than inner parts of the city, in large part because people of color have been economically displaced. 8 of those 48 people struck and killed by vehicles were Black, and Oregon Walks calculated that the death rate of Black pedestrians was 20 per 100,000, in other words, 3 times that of white pedestrians. A key factor is street lighting in those areas. 79% of the pedestrian fatalities came at night, including all of the Black pedestrians who were killed. Portland Bureau of Transportation spokesperson Dylan Rivera told Willamette Week that the agency spent $8 million on safety improvements in East Portland last year and is currently working on a $13.6 million project that includes new street lighting. But Timmer Ender, a Oregon Walks board member, says that these incidents are the result of a systemic problem faced by neighborhoods lacking resources, saying, quote, "This study says we need to up the urgency because this is not the only form of trauma Black people are facing." This year was the costliest wildfire season Oregon has ever seen. As a result, recent contracts to clean up the devastation are being called into question. Fires throughout the state scorched more than 1 million acres, destroyed 5,000 homes and other structures, claimed 9 lives. This prompted large amounts of federal money to be allocated to the state to aid in salvage and cleanup. Several national companies have been competing over these contracts, which are being managed by the Oregon Department of Transportation, or ODOT. ODOT is expected to dole out at least $600 million in contracts, with the money primarily supplied by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. One losing bidder is Ashbrit Environmental. They have made accusations against contractor ECC for, quote, "gaming the bid" to secure the contract. ECC is a California-based contractor. On November 17th, they won $89 million in contracts from Oregon to help remove tens of thousands of trees and debris damaged by this year's fires. In a protest letter filed on November 20th, Ashbrit said that ODOT grossly underreported the size of the job and that ECC lowballed the bid without considering the difficulty required to remove the damage. Attorneys for Ashbrit said in the complaint to ODOT, quote, "ECC gamed the pricing based on an apparent error in the bid sheets. That will work to the state's disadvantage when costs balloon to magnitudes higher than the current bid," unquote. Gaming is a term used in competitive bidding where a lowballed estimate ends up costing far more than initially quoted. Bid protests are also common, particularly when easily accessed funding from FEMA is behind the contract. ODOT spokeswoman Angela Beers Seidler said the agency is confident in its handling of what she called a, quote, "unprecedented process." Seidler said of the contracts already agreed upon, quote, "Our requests for proposals considered countless elements that will be faced in the field and is the product of significant deliberation and due diligence," unquote. Outgoing President Donald Trump announced today that he has issued a full pardon to former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Trump made the announcement via Twitter, writing, quote, "It is my great honor to announce that General Michael T. Flynn has been granted a full pardon. Congratulations to him and his wonderful family. I know you will now have a truly fantastic Thanksgiving." Flynn was Trump's first national security advisor, and at just a few weeks, his tenure was quite short. He later pled guilty twice to lying to the FBI during its investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 election. Trump said in March that he was considering pardoning Flynn and had indicated to his staff that he was planning to do so before leaving office. Experts view the move as Trump's acceptance that his time in office is coming to a close. He is expected to issue more pardons in the coming months before President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration in January. The final weeks of Donald Trump's presidency could see rapid changes to federal regulations ranging from chicken processing to the death penalty and immigrant pay. These last-minute changes to rules governing federal agencies are known as midnight regulations and are common in most lame duck periods for both parties. Outgoing presidents use their executive privilege to effect last-minute change to both benefit their legacies and hamper the incoming administration with a flood of work to undo. But the Trump administration is moving even faster, cutting timeframes for public comment in half and pushing through those rushed policy changes that may lack proper analysis and foresight. The most significant challenge to these midnight regulations is the Congressional Review Act, which Republicans used in 2017 to overturn a dozen rule changes made by former President Obama. With the Senate majority still up in the air, it's difficult to say whether next year's Congress will have the same power to overturn these regulations. One of the president's 36 planned rule changes could reintroduce firing squads and electrocutions in federal executions, as the government runs low on its favored injection drug. Though the Trump administration has approved 13 federal executions this year, Joe Biden has indicated that he will seek the elimination of capital punishment for federal crimes, so this rule change may never be put into practice. Other rules have more potential to affect everyday Americans. These include the EPA's slate of pollution regulation changes, including locking soot levels, even as experts have linked such pollution to increasing COVID complications and death. Pending immigration rules seek to restrict asylum seekers and lower the wages of immigrant farm workers. The Labor Department seeks to change the classification of independent contractors, such as Uber drivers, to ensure they don't qualify for full employee benefits. The USDA wants to increase the speed of chicken processing, something critics say could produce unsafe food and pose a risk to worker safety. Another fast-track change includes rushed attempts to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for drilling, with deadlines for oil company leases landing just before Inauguration Day. It's unclear how many of these proposals will be added to the Federal Register before Trump leaves office, but they could pose a significant threat to Biden's ability to implement his own agenda quickly. Matthew Kent, who tracks regulatory policy for Public Citizen, told ProPublica, quote, "The bottom line is the Trump administration is trying to get things published in the Federal Register, leaving the next administration to sort out the mess." KBOO News poet Dan Raphael says, thanks, and what's next?
I am thankful that Trump is leaving the White House, though I'd love to see it as a perp walk. Biden's first appointment show a fondness for American imperialism, the softly side of the big stick. Previous experience is not a plus when the system is unjust, corrupt, and addicted to power. Dumping Trump was just an appetizer, and we're a long way from a full meal deal. Biden will continue to feed the wrong mouse and far too few. This is an emergency, so why bring in folks who could have gotten us on a path for economic and ecological renewal 6 or so years ago and didn't? Maybe Biden will listen to national protests. Maybe Biden won't call in the National Guard. There's no maybe. This is the time to amplify our voices, get more bodies out in the streets, in the offices, to have some hope of a livable future. Thanks to those who have protested and continue to, and those who will join them. Thanks to those who help friends, neighbors, and strangers in ways no government seems willing to. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on restaurants weathering a second COVID lockdown in Portland, followed by News from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO. At 6, it's The Underground, then at 7, tune in for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be mostly cloudy with a low of 42. Tomorrow will also be cloudy with a high of 50. Today in history, in 1986, figure skater Debbie Thomas became the first African-American person to win the women's singles at the U.S. Figure Skating Championships. A month later, she went on to win the Women's World Figure Skating Championships. The quote of the day is from Black feminist, activist, and doula Adrienne Marie Brown, who wrote the book Emergent Strategy. Quote, "We are living now inside the imagination of people who thought economic disparity and environmental destruction were acceptable costs for their power. It is our right and responsibility to right ourselves into the future." Tribal leaders are urging people to avoid large gatherings over the long weekend. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Hunger relief groups and community organizations are concerned about food distribution funding running out of federal emergency aid by the end of the year. The lack of a new federal relief bill has local governments and nonprofits worried about how people will be able to survive the economic crisis. In Duluth, Minnesota, the American Indian Community House converted some of its space for food distribution and used emergency funds to install refrigerators and shelving. Leanne Littlewolf says they began providing food boxes and saw immediate demand, which could worsen if funds dry up.
We have a lot of people who they work in the service industry and in our local economy, that's a large part of the workforce. And then in our Native community, people have lost employment, have lost jobs. Some people don't have access to unemployment.
Little Wolf says the extra help from the federal government also allowed them to transport food. The state is working on a relief package as U.S. lawmakers are on break until after Thanksgiving. Tribal leaders and health officials across Indian country are urging people to stay home and not hold large gatherings this week due to COVID-19. The Tulalip tribes in Washington are asking people to rethink sharing a Thanksgiving meal in person with extended family members as Tulalip's COVID-19 cases are surging. Emergency managers say they're seeing COVID fatigue in the community before the big national travel and gathering days and are asking people to hold virtual celebrations. The Navajo Nation is giving out turkeys and food distribution boxes. The tribe is under a 3-week lockdown due to a rise in new cases. President Jonathan Nez was handing out food boxes in Red Valley, Arizona, Tuesday, and spoke during a town hall asking people to stay home.
We're not encouraging large gatherings by giving out turkey, but we all know and recognize that there are people are struggling right now to have food on the table. The food that they're going to cook is with their immediate family. That's what we're encouraging.
The tribe's turkey distribution continues Wednesday in Crown Point, New Mexico. In Eugene, Oregon, the curtain has risen on a new Native American dramatic arts venue. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, its goal is to celebrate and foster authentic indigenous theater.
The company's name is Ililu, which is a Kayapuya word for joyous. Co-founder Lori Tapahanzo coordinates Lane Community College's Native American student program, but is also a lifelong thespian. She says a Native theater company like Ililu gives indigenous performers the opportunity to be authentic and true to their culture.
Although theater is about putting on masks and moving into character, on the flip side of that, it's also about us being able to be true to our stories and the audience being able to accept exactly what we're saying, how we present it, and the way that we mean. That's the beauty of theater, but specifically Native theater.
The show opened last Friday with three short works. The first, titled The Woman Who Was a Red Deer Dressed for the Deer Dance, was first performed in New York 25 years ago. Cherokee playwright Diane Glancy says she's honored to have her work featured.
It's about a grandmother and her granddaughter in the different ways of life, the more traditional and the more contemporary, and they get into a conflict.
I've got a granddaughter, and I would like to talk to her and show her certain things, and she isn't terribly interested right now. She's a junior in high school. So that difference between generations has always been on my mind.
Another goal for Ilulu is to consult other regional theaters on portraying Native American themes and characters with accuracy and sensitivity. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is taking a final shot by making it difficult for the Biden administration to access over $450 billion in unspent coronavirus relief funds. Mnuchin has signaled that he plans to transfer the money that was allocated in the CARES Act to the Treasury's general fund, which would mean accessing the money requires the approval of Congress. Today, the Republican-majority Senate has blocked all other House-approved bills for further COVID-19 relief. Republicans on the Senate Banking Committee applauded Mnuchin, saying he is faithfully following the intent and letter of the law. Barhad Ramaturi, a member of the Congressional Commission established to oversee the use of coronavirus relief money, tweeted of Mnuchin's fund transfer, quote, "The good news is that it's illegal and can be reversed next year." According to the U.S. Census Bureau's most recent pandemic survey, 5.6 million American households struggled to put enough food on the table last week. 27% of Black respondents and 23% of Latino respondents with children reported not having enough to eat sometimes or often over the past week, compared with just 12% of white respondents. Zuani Villarreal is a spokesperson for Feeding America, which is a network of 200 food banks worldwide. Villarreal said, quote, "Across the country, demand has not let up, and food banks do everything they can to make sure families have food on the table for Thanksgiving. Since the start of the pandemic, 40% of people seeking food aid are first-timers, and even before the pandemic, 35 million Americans relied on food banks every year. But this year, as many as 54 million people in the United States could experience hunger, including a quarter of all children, thanks to the global pandemic and inaction from local and national governments." How can social media be less polarizing? Here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks. She's got some ideas.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
It's a team that reflects the fact that America is back, ready to lead the world, not retreat from it.
President-elect Joe Biden introduces nominees for cabinet positions in Wilmington Tuesday, the first day of the official presidential transition. Many are trailblazers, including Linda Thomas Greenfield, who would be the first African-American woman to serve as United States Ambassador to the United Nations. Janet Yellen, Biden's expected Treasury pick, was the first woman to chair the Federal Reserve. If confirmed, she would also be the first woman Treasury Secretary. Yellen talks to CBS about what it's like breaking glass ceilings.
I've tried to do a good job. I suppose a theme of my life is that I try to be prepared and to get good grades. And I do want to show that women can perform well in these positions.
The Biden nominees spoke of a more compassionate America. Secretary of State nominee Tony Blinken recalls how his late stepfather was a child Holocaust survivor in concentration camps and was hiding in a forest at the end of World War II. Then, Blinken's stepfather saw American troops.
He ran to the tank. The hatch opened. An African-American GI looked down at him. He got down on his knees and said the only three words that he knew in English that his mother had taught him before the war. God bless America. That's who we are.
With Pennsylvania, Nevada, North Carolina, and Minnesota certifying their election results, Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris garnered a new U.S. record, surpassing 80 million votes, more than 6 million above the Trump ticket. But despite a coalition of federal and state officials from both parties saying there's no evidence votes were altered in the presidential election, the American public remains deeply divided. A new Pew report says close to 95% of Biden supporters say the elections were run well. Only 21% of Trump supporters say the same. One obvious culprit of polarization and misinformation is social media. For example, 64% of people who found extremist groups on Facebook were driven there by Facebook's recommendation system, according to a leaked Facebook document reported in the Wall Street Journal. Jessica Gonzalez, co-CEO of media advocacy group Free Press, says they are pushing for a data privacy bill as a way to fight this.
One of the ways that disinformation and hate spread is by the extractive policies that Facebook and Twitter have, where they're actually collecting and harvesting our personal information and then using them to allow these actors to target us.
She hopes the Biden administration will curb how social media profit from user data, which could decrease extremism online. Free Press also supports the Honest Ads Act.
In broadcast, we know when we see a political advertisement, we know who it's coming from and who paid for that. We, even if we don't know the name of the PAC, we can track it down. We need something similar in the social media space. That's one intervention.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
Conversations with family around the holidays can be stressful, so here is the Public News Service Diane Bernard with some tips on how best to communicate around the dinner table.
Holiday conversations can be stressful, especially in a year filled with misinformation and disinformation about the election, the pandemic, and racial protests. But experts say folks can use compassion at this year's Thanksgiving table to challenge tricky subjects. Bridget Todd with the group Ultraviolet points out that distortions spread on social media by playing on people's fears and mistrust of other groups. She says families can approach relatives who may have been misled with empathy, using verified facts and avoiding escalation.
As much as it can be hard, as much as you don't want to talk about politics, and I get it, I have my own wild cousins posting wild stuff in the family group chat. I think that it's really important that we remember that and critical role that just being a trusted source of accurate information is in the fight to curb disinformation.
She says she tracked social media campaigns that spread mistrust in communities of color about mail-in ballots, and Facebook says it posted warnings on more than 150 million posts between March and September as part of its effort to protect election integrity. Todd spoke at an online event by PEN America on how to handle difficult holiday discussions about politics and misinformation. Another panelist, psychology professor Linda Fazio, says everybody falls for disinformation at some point. She says research shows it's simple for people to fool even themselves, especially through repetition.
It's easy to think that I'm above all this. And it's just like my dumb cousin who falls for misinformation, and I would never do something like that. And that's just not how it works.
Carnegie Mellon University researchers analyzed more than 200 million tweets about COVID-19 between January and May. Of the top 50 influential retweeters, it found 82% were bots, intentionally passing along misinformation. For Maryland News Connection, I'm Diane Bernard.
Why don't frightening facts move people to action on climate change? A conversational approach often works better. That's according to psychologist Renee Lertman. With more on the story, here's Dr. Anthony Lizowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Anger, anxiety, overwhelm. Climate change can evoke intense feelings.
It's easy to feel dwarfed in the context of such a global systemic issue.
Psychologist Renee Lerstman says that when people experience these feelings, they often shut down and push information away. So to encourage climate action, she advises not bombarding people with frightening facts.
When we lead with information, we are actually unwittingly walking right into a situation that is set up to undermine our efforts.
She says if you want to engage people on the topic, take a compassionate approach. Ask people what they know and want to learn. Then have a conversation. This conversational approach may seem at odds with the urgency of the issue, but Lerchman says it can get results faster.
When we take a compassion-based approach, we are actively disarming defenses so that people are actually more willing and able to respond and engage quicker. And we don't have time right now, you know, to mess around. And so I do actually come to this topic with a sense of urgency. We do not have time to not take this approach.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 25th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Samantha Law, Dan Raphael, and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Diane Bernard, Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Since March, the food and beverage industry has struggled to remain afloat during the ongoing novel coronavirus pandemic. In this segment, I am speaking with three business owners in the Westmoreland Selwood neighborhood of Southeast Portland. Though all reopened under Multnomah County's Phase 1 reopening orders, they are now shuttered again following Governor Kate Brown's recent freeze orders. Vicki Loring is the owner of Fat Albert's Breakfast Cafe, a family-owned restaurant that was getting ready to celebrate their 20th year anniversary being open. That's before COVID hit. I asked Loring about her challenges ahead.
Just the challenges for the mind of a business owner is you got to stay one step ahead. You know, where is this going to take the business? Are we going to be able to reopen? Am I going to have my employees? First time around, you know, there was fear, there was worry. Not only did it last longer than we thought, then they started discussing phases. And we were put in, as anybody knows about Multnomah County, into a phase one. The challenges were, you know, you want to keep your name out there. You want to keep your business going. You want to survive. And to the point where they're going to let you reopen, you thought you were going to reopen. So for Multnomah County, some of the other counties were able to open around us before us. And that kind of hurt our industry in Multnomah, and we didn't get the pop everybody else got, because once they lifted it and went to phase one, people just went out to literally 5 minutes from us, which is Clackamas County. So now we're facing another one. So yes, you know, this time around, you kind of know what to expect, but what you don't know what to expect is how long is it going to last? That's the fear. And the fear is, you watched during the first time around, we're talking long time restaurants, long time bars, 40 years, 20 years dropping off. Can they survive? What happened to them that they felt that they needed to close? You know, some businesses got assistance, you know, some businesses did not. And this time around, is there going to be assistance for us to survive this? We're being told it's a freeze. Maybe that's a nice way of psychologically making us think, oh, this isn't going to be very long, just a few weeks to get it under control. I mean, it's my livelihood. It's my family's livelihood. It's a breakfast cafe, so I also support the lives of my employees. You know, what's going to happen this time? You know, are they going to get help? You know, obviously, I'm looking for, you know, some sort of assistance. I'll do what I need to do to try to survive this. For people that you employ, they have lives as well. You know, are they still going to be around? Are they going to last this time? You got to think about that, too. You might last, but, you know, they might have to do what they have to do to move on.
Following Governor Brown's March 17th shutter-in-place orders, bars and restaurants began closing their doors, leaving many owners scrambling to make hard choices. Loring became increasingly frustrated in attempts to secure economic assistance for her restaurant from both federal and local governments.
Yes, there were some of us that got help. There were some of us that didn't get help. So I'm hearing about different things. So the Earl Blumenhauer was really pushing for the Restaurant Act. Apparently, on his response to me, is it has been passed. Half the Senate passed it. The President of the United States was for it, but it's being held up. So we're waiting for that to pass. That's something that's coming from the federal government. It will be dispersed to each state. It'll be up to the governor to do what they want to do with it. Equally, I was also advised to check into a website that I was totally unaware of as a restaurant owner, and it's called the State of Oregon's Emergency Business Assistance Grant Fund. How I found out about this is I was pretty upset about when the governor came on a week ago and talked about the new freeze and how she wants it to be done. And then I immediately following that, Ted Wheeler talked about how he had help from federal, but where is the state help from the state of Oregon for, in fact, small businesses? So he comes on, he says, well, we've distributed $20 million to the Reliance CARES Act, and we've distributed another $12 million, you know, through another organization. And I was shocked to hear that, because I would like to know where and when and how was that made public knowledge, and how was that distributed? So upon digging into this, that's when I was led to this website, which surprised me because I've never heard about it. I've talked to a couple other business owners in the Selwood Westmoreland community, small business owners, that being a key fact, and found this website. So on this website, I clicked on it. They emailed me at 2:45, so I didn't get my email right away. When I did get my email, opened it up, it said there was funds being given out to small businesses, but it was gone within minutes, and the applications closed at 3 p.m. You know, I talked to several business owners, and nobody's heard of it. And apparently, this grant fund on this website is on its fifth round. So a little shocked about that. So, you know, we're all looking for, yes, how long is this going to go on, and are we going to receive assistance from the state of Oregon, which I don't think we did last time. There was two grants that went out called the Prosper Portland Grant, one in April and one in June, but it was for minorities only and women-owned businesses. In the Selwood Westmoreland area, I know a lot of the business owners, and I'd say 60% of them, if not more, are women-owned businesses. I contacted them all that I know. Not one person received that. So that was in April and then again in June. Kind of a small little bit of a grant by Prosper Portland, but that is not from money from the state of Oregon. So my question is, where is our assistance from the state of Oregon?
Ryan Rollins is the owner of PDX Sliders, an establishment that began as a humble food truck roughly 6 years ago, and since then has grown to include two food trucks and two brick and mortars. And though his doors closed in March, he was able to stay afloat by providing to-go food options. As Rollins enters the second round of closure, he is also facing concerns, which are beginning to sound all too familiar. How long will we be closed? Will I be able to keep my staff? And what awaits for me when we are allowed to reopen again?
The first go-around that we did was obviously a lot more challenging. We had no idea what, you know, we were getting into or what we were doing. You know, like everybody had to wing it. We did, you know, I think, you know, when the first shutdown happened, you know, a lot of stuff hadn't been ironed out, such as masks, distance, you know, all these things that have been changing monthly or weekly, even to date, that we've been trying to, you know, wrap our head around. You know, how can we make customers safe? How can we keep employees? How can we keep the doors open? And I think that's exactly the same thing that every small business owner, especially in the restaurant industry, has been trying to figure out. You know, some retailers can pivot to online sales or whatnot, but food has to be sold, food has to be picked up, people have to eat it. So a lot of logistical things, you know, went into that versus some of your traditional businesses. But, you know, we were fortunate in regards to some businesses where we already had Caviar, Postmates, Uber Eats, and all these different delivery apps. We already had all these set up. So just the sheer volume, though, of the increase, you know, made us have to pivot kind of the internal operations. And I guess more so than that was having to lay people off, which was not something we looked forward to doing and we didn't, you know, enjoy doing. And there's no easy way to lay one person off versus the other or anything like that. You know, some people go to a seniority model or whatever the case may be, but finding a way to get food out the door was okay. You know, letting people go was a hard part. So we had to have those difficult talks. We had to separate with some of our employees. Fortunately for us, though, it ended up being for only a short period of time, I think maybe a month or two, once we wrapped our head around and got a grasp of the volume that we were able to do and the amount of orders that we saw coming in, we knew how many people that we could facilitate. So a couple months into it, we were able to actually bring all of our people back and some. So there's a couple that didn't feel comfortable coming back to work or chose to go the unemployment route for the safety of their families. Some people are immune compromised and all that stuff. So, you know, and we respected all that stuff. But nevertheless, we were able to bring everybody back, and that was, you know, really nice, and it made us feel better as a business. And we were, you know, very heavily supported, you know, by, you know, our regular customers and people in the neighborhood, and a lot of people that we had been given to throughout the year in various forms definitely showed up and supported us hand over fist, week over week, day after day. And it really got us to where we are here now for shutdown number two. So shutdown number two is a little less, you know, worrisome. You know, we're definitely very worried as far as like the industry as a whole. And there's a lot of people out there that didn't recover from the first shutdown, and there are a lot of people that never came back from the first shutdown. So all in all, we feel very fortunate to be where we're at. Again, though, we had to go through another round of layoffs, hopefully for a short term. You know, she said it's 4 weeks. I bet it's going to be substantially longer than that. So, you know, we're just trying to be here for our employees however we can, even if they're working for us or not working for us. You know, we got the food portion down, and we know how to get food out. We know how to get it to the customers, and we have that all ironed out. So our main thing is just trying to, you know, keep that alive, and that allows us to, you know, do what we can for our employees.
Chris Garcia has been the owner of the Cosmo Lounge for roughly 12 years and chose not to reopen on June 19th when Multnomah County went into Phase 1. She intended on waiting until Phase 2 with hopes of having longer hours and counter service. She eventually did reopen her doors mid-August, only to find herself shuttering again with Brown's freeze orders.
One of my biggest fears is how long this will last. I wasn't surprised having another closure. I, you know, assumed that it would happen. I kind of hoped that it would have been after the holidays, but, you know, we just rolling with it. And in regards to reaching out for any support, it's very limited, and there really isn't a lot of exposure for mapped out for us of where to reach out. Fortunately, I've been in contact with a great community of other women-owned bars and restaurants in Portland, and just happened to learn of the grant that was being issued by the governor that we all heard on the news. And, you know, it had been, I had known about it, but I really wasn't clear on when and how. And, I mean, as quickly as I learned about it, all the funds were actually already allocated. And that was a matter of 3 minutes. So it's challenging. It's hard to, you know, really have direction of how to navigate this. And, I mean, my concern is for my staff, the community. We've really tried to follow the, guidelines for healthy reopening. My staff spends equal amount of time serving as much as cleaning. And I've had great input from my community. The patrons have been very patient and appreciative of the work that we've done. You know, oftentimes they'll have to wait a few minutes so that we can sanitize appropriately and just make sure, you know, we're following safety measures. So in regards to the closure happening and the bars and restaurants having to completely shut down again, I understand it, like, these aren't easy choices to make. And it's so hard with, you know, choosing who actually gets to stay open as opposed to closing. I feel that in a lot of ways, our industry has kind of taken the brunt of it a little bit. And maybe there would be more of a comfort level if we were being maybe inspected more. I'm really not sure how to move forward with that. It's hard. We're really trying to keep everyone safe. And but at the same time, I mean, the reality of not knowing when we could possibly reopen, and I mean, just having a closed facility is thousands of dollars a month. I've heard from patrons that, you know, our neighborhood businesses are some of the cleanest and really adhere to
sanitizing very thoroughly. Most people appreciate that. Sometimes people feel inconvenienced and, you know, they'll say, well, we don't see this happening everywhere. And maybe that's a cause of, but I don't feel from the numbers that I've seen and from the information that I've watched from our local government, it doesn't appear that cases have really been traced back to our industry. But again, it's hard. I mean, I understand the frustration of, for example, parents and, you know, children not being able to be in school. And it's just so hard. But Portland being a service industry town, I've lived in Portland for 30 years. I mean, the service industry has been a huge factor in this community. And I'm really worried to take away from that.
As new COVID-19 case counts continue to climb, owners question as to whether they will be allowed to open in late December, as scheduled, with most anticipating staying shuttered well into January after the holiday season has passed. With hopes of the infection curve flattening and news of a potential vaccine looming, fingers remain crossed that an expedient return to another Phase 1 reopening will see Portland's businesses survive. For the bars and restaurants of Portland, this is just another chapter in the wrenching ongoing saga of COVID-19. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.